With the reversal of Roe versus Wade, the fight for life now goes to the states. I'm Mark Irons with an update on state marches for life across the country.
The chemical abortion drugs are serious drugs. They are drugs that have serious side effects.
Pro-life health professionals work to educate the public on the dangers of abortion pills as the federal government makes it easier to get them at the pharmacy and through the mail.
I'm Alan Holden in Oklahoma City, where I'm taking a closer look at security at mass, both hired guards who carry weapons openly and private individuals who carry concealed weapons. That story ahead.
And when you're listening to your pastor preach, how long is too long? This week, Pope Francis called long-winded homilies a disaster. We will discuss. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
And so we will continue to march. We will continue to march until the human rights abuse of abortion is a thing of the past. We will march until abortion is unthinkable.
Marching forward in a post-Roe America. After last year's major ruling from the Supreme Court, a look ahead to the next crucial steps to support women and defend the unborn. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. 1 week ago at this time, the National March for Life was wrapping up its 50th anniversary, having outlived the Supreme Court case it protested for five decades. The High Court's decision to overturn Roe versus Wade last summer left people wondering whether the country's largest annual pro-life event would continue. But the size of the crowd that came back to Washington, D.C. last weekend surpassed all expectations, and the enthusiasm was electric. Pro-life advocates flooded the streets, and the excitement was tangible as joyful marchers celebrated the end of Roe. This year, the march traveled past the Capitol building, signifying the continued effort to pass federal laws that defend the unborn. And like previous marches, the route ended in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. While the National March remained a big draw, all eyes are turning to the states, as individual state legislatures now have the power to pass abortion laws that reflect the views of their citizens. That means state marches are more significant. Mark Irons has that story from North Carolina.
When I say pro, you say life. Pro.
Life.
Pro.
Life.
From coast to coast.
We are
pro. Life.
We're hearing chants to end abortion, signs proclaiming the right to life. A message counter to what is often seen in popular culture.
They're giving a false narrative about what abortion is. I think that we need to have the truth out there.
You know, our human rights begin when we're at conception, when we become a human.
People rallying in North Carolina told us this isn't just about saving preborn lives.
You will quickly see that we are not only pro-birth. Yes, I do want babies to be born, but we're also pro-woman and pro-family.
I was really a statistic for abortion.
For many, it's personal. As a 20-year-old, Elizabeth Harris found herself in a crisis pregnancy. She faced all the challenges many women who choose abortion face.
You know, financial stress, relationship stress, no support system, no higher education. That was me.
But she chose life for her now 21-year-old daughter, Lourdes. And as a member of Sidewalk Advocates for Life, Harris works full-time, offering a listening ear, prayer, material aid, and resources to women.
We are there to be the hands and feet of Christ, to say, I'm here, I care about you, and I want to help you right now.
A final lifeline to those on the brink of choosing abortion. A regular presence outside a Planned Parenthood abortion clinic in Asheville, North Carolina, Harris says with the reversal of Roe versus Wade, the pro-life mission isn't over, but it is becoming more complex.
And I'm seeing tons of out-of-state license plates, mostly out-of-state license plates coming in.
She describes North Carolina as a destination state for abortion. People driving from places like Tennessee, Kentucky, and Alabama, where state restrictions on abortion are greater. We met with Harris in Raleigh, the capital of North Carolina, at a statewide pro-life march a week before the 50th annual March for Life in Washington, D.C. That national march brings pro-lifers throughout the U.S. together around the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, and organizers say it will continue. But the reversal of Roe last summer gave individual states the power to legislate on abortion, and pro-life rallies and marches at the state level now take on even greater significance. So far this year, we've seen marches in Colorado, Georgia, New Hampshire, Iowa, Minnesota, and Idaho, to name a few. Each march hoping to build steps toward a culture of life and, where needed, to update the law.
Every state looks a little different. Here in North Carolina, there's a ban on abortion after 20 weeks, but these pro-life advocates say there's a lot more to fight for.
In North Carolina, we're hoping to get protection for the unborn at the heartbeat level.
Retired medical doctor Bill Pincus is the president of North Carolina Right to Life and organizer of this state march. He says the next political goal here, pass a bill to ban abortion after an unborn child's heartbeat is detected, about 5 to 6 weeks in pregnancy. Pincus says the vast majority of abortions take place around that time, so a heartbeat law could save many lives.
It saves about 85%, so 25,000 babies in North Carolina would be saved.
But North Carolina, like many other states, finds itself in a complex situation politically. The state legislature may lean pro-life, but even if lawmakers passed a heartbeat bill, the current governor, Democrat Roy Cooper, would not sign it into law.
Abortion is not compatible with this nation.
The second in command, North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, is very supportive of unborn life, and he's calling on every state to step up.
All politics are local, and this country's not going to straighten out unless the states band together and get it straightened out.
Still, for someone who is a politician and even considering a run for governor, Robinson makes it clear ending abortion will not come through lawmaking or protesting alone.
We always need to make sure that we have compassion for people. That's the number one thing. We've got to keep our compassion.
It's personal for him. He and his wife regret an abortion they had years ago before they were married.
We did not choose life. And it's been something that's been very heartbreaking for the both of us for very many years. To me, this has always been a spiritual issue. It's more than a political issue. And I really think the mantle needs to be taken up inside the churches because we need to change hearts and minds.
For Elizabeth Harris, her pro-life views came through a conversion to Catholicism.
I completely had, a 180 in my life because of the sacraments, because of the healing and reconciliation, because of the beautiful teaching of the Catholic Church.
In all the marches taking place around the U.S., chances are there will be some kind of Catholic presence.
First and the most important resources that the Church has is each one of us.
Bishop Luis Zarama of Raleigh celebrated a Mass for Life before the march in North Carolina. He's not preaching about a particular pro-life initiative or effort to overturn laws. He's not hyper-focused on activism. His message is much, much deeper.
I have hope. And whatever I try to do, I try to do with love. We cannot give what we don't have.
Zarama says Catholics can open themselves to the abundant love of Christ through prayer and reception of the sacraments. After being filled with that love, mercy, compassion, and hope can be shared with others, including those who advocate for abortion, or those in need of healing from it, or those who feel abortion is their only option.
We bring hope, and hope is the key to open someone for a conversation, and that is when things start to become different.
When the march is over, the mission doesn't stop. Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
And another state marched this week in Kansas. The state had a pro-life setback last summer when the Value Them Both ballot initiative failed, which would have allowed for limits on abortion in Kansas. But now the state's bishops are placing their hope in a new generation of pro-life leaders to take up the cause. This week's State March for Life in Topeka brought hundreds of high school students, many part of Catholic school delegations. Salina Bishop Jerry Vinke says their robust presence is a sign of things to come.
I really believe that these young people are going to influence people in college and in the future to choose life. And that's why I have so much hope. And ultimately, truth wins in the end, right? I mean, evil always defeats itself. So that's why I have so much hope.
The young pro-lifers also attended a rally and mass with bishops from across Kansas at the Topeka Performing Arts Center. And the Southwest March for Life in New Mexico is this weekend. To discuss the importance of these regional efforts, we're joined by Mark Cavalier, CEO of Southwest Coalition for Life, which covers two states, both New Mexico and Texas. Mark, thank you for being with us. Tell us about the Southwest Coalition for Life. Is it usual to have state efforts banded together?
You know, in our unique area, we've always covered, you know, been started in southern New Mexico and the West Texas area of El Paso, which is kind of this one big regional area. So we've seen a lot of growing unity in the years leading up to this, but especially now since the overturn of Roe versus Wade, that it's come down to a state by state. We've really seen, because of the restrictions that are protecting life in the state of Texas, which is amazing, we're seeing a huge influx of women traveling from across the state of Texas, just across the state line into the southern part of New Mexico and Albuquerque, sometimes driving, traveling 16 hours or more. And so we've seen an increase in interstate unity between Texas and New Mexico, as Texas is saying, you know, we need to, you know, help our neighbors in New Mexico, as well as continue to provide more support so, you know, women don't feel like they have to travel that far and go so far out of their way in the first place.
And we've heard that they need care on the other side, depending on what decision they make. I'm sure this weekend's march is different than past years. What motivated you to march in Las Cruces, New Mexico?
Las Cruces, New Mexico has kind of become a new front line, in a sense, as Reuters News called it, the abortion battle that's really come to New Mexico. Texas, as I mentioned, is restricting abortion. The state of New Mexico has zero restrictions on abortion up to the moment of delivery for any reason, even minors without parental consent, paid for by state tax dollars in many cases, including the abortion business at the center of Dobbs versus Jackson, the Jackson Women's Health Organization that led to the overturn of Roe after they could no longer operate in Mississippi, now has moved to Las Cruces, New Mexico, to open up what they're calling the Pink House West. And so that, as well as many other abortion businesses flocking to New Mexico to really exploit and take advantage of the lack of restrictions, it was only appropriate that we move our march. In the past has been on the El Paso on the Texas side, but now with the battle being so important there, so many are traveling from Texas as well as the northern part of the state down just for this march in Las Cruces.
And you just mentioned the lack of restrictions in New Mexico. It's the only state bordering Texas where abortion is legal. How does that impact your coalition's work?
It has been the last few months, we have seen almost every day, you know, a couple dozen cars, all Texas license plates, you know, women traveling from Texas. And it has made it so much harder. You know, used to we had a lot of successes in helping change women's minds and present them with alternatives. But so often now they're saying, you know, I got to catch a flight in a few hours. We've already put so much time and invested so much into this travel for this trip, and they feel so much more committed to that decision. It's made it much more harder to reach out to them, which is one reason why we're now opening a new Guiding Star Comprehensive Women's Health Center right next door to this new Pink House abortion location.
That's a big challenge. And is border security affecting your work as well? It seems that we talk about women who are citizens of this country, but immigrants are also vulnerable to abortion.
You know, we've seen in the migrant shelters in this area where abortion organizations like Planned Parenthood have gone into the shelters for even migrants who are coming through following the right process, saying this is the American way. Let us help you out if you're pregnant, and giving them the abortion pill and then leaving them there to bleed. And so many are going through this experience and, you know, feeling that this is actually opposing the values that they're trying to, you know, come into this country for their children. And so it's definitely something that we're very affected by.
Well, we've talked about the lack of restrictions in New Mexico, but with the abortion bans passed in Texas, is your work there done?
Not at all. It's more important than ever that organizations on the Texas side do more to help women. Just because abortion is more difficult to find doesn't mean that crisis pregnancies have ended by any stretch of the imagination. So more than ever before, the communities in the states that have restricted abortion need to step up and make sure that more services, more help is provided, and that women know about that help and support that's in their town so they don't travel to New Mexico, where we have to try to reach out to them at the last possible moment.
Well, we'll be tracking this closely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our discussion on the future of the pro-life movement continues with details on recent changes from the Food and Drug Administration. There's much more ahead on EWTN News In Depth.
Chemical abortion is the present of abortion. It's also the future of abortion. It's easier to access, but that's going to lead to a lot more complications and issues for those who take it.
Next, abortion pills. With increasing restrictions against surgical abortions across the country, a look at what's already the next battleground in this post-Roe world.
You know, it's sad that we're in that kind of a situation, but I think that it is a great blessing that we can provide this security for our parishioners so that they can come and pray and worship and receive the sacraments without worrying about their safety.
More and more parishes are turning to armed guards and sometimes armed church members to safeguard their sanctuaries. A report from the Heartland coming up.
Falcon is a man's world, and I wasn't really aware of that when I came here. I was just thinking, I want to heal the falcons.
And we go to the United Arab Emirates to meet the executive director of the world's largest falcon hospital, a rare Catholic and a rare woman of high position in a Muslim land. Her story ahead.
Pro-life movement is shifting gears to the states, abortion pills continue to be a crucial issue on the national stage. To mark the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, President Biden ordered federal agencies on Sunday to protect and increase access to chemical abortions, which now make up more than half of all abortions. In his order, President Biden promised to protect reproductive rights, saying, "My administration remains committed to supporting safe access to mifepristone, or the abortion pill, and defending women's fundamental freedoms." Chemical abortion by pill, often completed at home, sometimes but not always under the supervision of a medical professional, is the next frontier in the abortion battle. Reporter Rizal Rages explains.
The federal government strengthened abortion access at the beginning of the year, making the so-called abortion pill mifepristone, or RU486, more readily available nationwide. Sean Carney is president and CEO of 40 Days for Life, an international 40-day campaign that aims to end abortion. He says increased access to RU486 will have detrimental consequences.
This is a controversial two-pill process that is brutal on women, and I don't think Walgreens or CVS has a clue of what they've done or what they're getting into.
CVS and Walgreens, the two largest drugstore chains in the country, are seeking certification to offer the pill after the Food and Drug Administration finalized its policy allowing pharmacies to dispense mifepristone. For the first time in states where abortion is still legal, patients with a prescription can now obtain the abortion pill directly from retail pharmacies. OBGYN Dr. Ingrid Skopp is the director of medical affairs at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. She has personally seen the horrors of chemical abortion. In her home state of Texas, the two-pill regimen is banned after 7 weeks of pregnancy. She says doctors frequently see women suffering complications after taking the pills.
Even though the abortions are not being performed in clinics in our state, unfortunately, these chemical abortion pills are coming in. These women have abortions, but they have no provider. So when they have complications, they're abandoned, essentially. Just a week ago, I had to do surgery on another woman who had obtained an abortion in California because it's illegal in Texas, and yet she came to Texas. She had her complication in Texas.
Dr. Skopp explains the process of chemical abortion.
A chemical abortion is provided with two medications. Mifepristone is also known as RU486 or Mifeprex. And this medicine blocks the progesterone receptors, which are crucial to continue to provide hormonal support to a pregnancy. So that causes the embryo or the fetus to die.
In 24 to 48 hours later, it is followed by the second drug called misoprostol, which induces labor to expel the unborn child and placental tissue from the uterus. Mifepristone, in combination with misoprostol, is used to terminate pregnancies up to 10 weeks. In 2020, medication abortion accounted for 54% of all pregnancy terminations in the U.S., according to Guttmacher Institute, a think tank that keeps track of reproductive rights globally. However, a looming case in Texas challenging the FDA's approval of abortion pills could halt the use of medication abortion in the country. In November last year, a group of doctors led by the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine sued the FDA for what it calls inadequate screening of the abortion drug regimen. The group, including the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or APLOG, argued that the agency did not have proof of the medication's safety.
We're hoping for a decision from the court within the next few months, and then hopefully at that point we'll get a positive decision and these dangerous drugs will take off the marketplace.
The FDA never required an ultrasound. They never required the basic safety requirements.
The FDA first approved mifepristone in the year 2000 to end pregnancies through 7 weeks, which was later extended to 10 weeks in 2016. FDA continued to loosen restrictions in 2019 when the agency lifted the in-person requirement to obtain mifepristone, allowing patients to receive the medication by mail. In defense of the FDA decision, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says this is an important step forward, allowing more patients who need mifepristone for medication abortion additional options to secure this vital drug. In addition to the FDA's new policy change, the Justice Department gave the all clear for the U.S. Postal Service to continue mailing abortion pills.
And DOJ, instead of looking at the text of the law, said that USPS could mail it if the intent of the sender was not that the drugs would be used illegally wherever it was being sent.
Rachel Morrison, an attorney and fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, explains that the opinion provides legal protection to the Postal Service, but does not necessarily protect individuals who either distribute or take the pills.
It's just that, an opinion. It doesn't actually change the legal requirements, and it doesn't prohibit anyone who mails the drugs from the USPS from being prosecuted. Anyone who violates the law right now could still be held criminally liable under that law in the future.
According to the Guttmacher Institute, as of January 2023, these 29 states shown in light yellow require abortion pills to be administered by physicians. Of those, 18 states require a physician to be physically present when the pills are administered, and two states prohibit the use of medication abortion starting at a specific point in pregnancy.
Morrison believes chemical abortion is the next major sticking point in the ongoing nationwide fight over abortion access.
Chemical abortion is the present of abortion. It's also the future of abortion. It's easier to access.
Both Dr. Scott and Dr. Harrison send a message to other pro-life advocates. Stay educated and continue to fight for life.
But we need to be able to educate our friends about what's going on, because I think too few people really understand the situation on the ground.
I would encourage anyone who is pro-life to become aware of how abortion hurts women and how it ends the life of a human being in the womb.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
The legal fight over mifepristone continues. On Wednesday, word of two new lawsuits challenging abortion pill restrictions in North Carolina and West Virginia. The pair of lawsuits seeks to settle the question whether states can regulate and restrict FDA-approved drugs. Meanwhile, just last month, the FDA changed language for the packaging for Plan B, or the morning-after pill, to say it can only prevent a pregnancy, not terminate one. It had previously claimed the drug could prevent a fertilized egg from implanting. Unlike the abortion pill, Plan B is available over the counter with no prescription needed and no age restrictions. In response to the change in packaging language, Dr. Harrison from the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists said, "The fact is, depending on the time during her reproductive cycle that a woman consumes Plan B, the drug may have the potential to stop an embryo from implanting in her uterus, thus ending an early human life. We encourage the FDA to include all the relevant information about this drug on its label and encourage women to consider all available information about Plan B before taking it." Next, Pope Francis shares some candid opinions and makes headlines this week. Astonishing comments about homosexuality in an interview with the Associated Press, and a critique of homilies that drag on and on. A lively debate on that when we return. Pope Francis conveyed several messages to the faithful in his weekly general audience on Wednesday. He urged Catholics to share the gospel joyfully and not to induce feelings of guilt in others. And in recognition of International Holocaust Remembrance Day on January 27th, the Holy Father condemned Holocaust deniers, saying the extermination of millions of Jews and people of other faiths can neither be forgotten nor denied. And remarks Pope Francis made about homosexuality this week got a lot of attention. In an interview with the Associated Press, he criticized laws that criminalize homosexuality as unjust. Francis is quoted saying, "Being homosexual isn't a crime. It is a human condition." He goes on to say, "It's a sin. First, let's distinguish between a sin and a crime." Pope Francis was referencing the some 67 countries on jurisdictions worldwide that criminalize same-sex activity between two consenting adults, according to 2020 research by a worldwide LGBTQ equality federation. You can see those highlighted in shades of orange and red on this map, portraying various lengths of imprisonment. The countries in dark red are those that can impose the death penalty for same-sex activity. Francis called on bishops who support those laws to have a, quote, conversion of heart to welcome LGBTQ people into the church. He also urged church leaders to fight for an end to such laws. We spoke with EWTN News executive editor and Washington, D.C. bureau chief Dr. Matthew Bunsen about the Pope's statements.
The Catechism is clear in stressing that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered, but also at the same time, the Catechism stresses the importance of recognizing the dignity of the human person and overcoming and resisting all forms of intolerance and violations against that human dignity. Pope Francis has a tendency, given his pastoral orientation, to sort of switch the order of those paragraphs. So he always starts with the pastoral care and also fighting all injustices. But then he also does restate Catholic teaching as he tries to here.
And these papal comments are also raising eyebrows. In remarks to diocesan liturgical directors last week, Pope Francis called long and abstract homilies a disaster. The Holy Father urged priests to keep homilies to no more than 8 to 10 minutes and to include a thought, a feeling, and an image, so that people may bring something home with them. The Holy Father also encouraged priests to use their pastoral senses to improve parishioners' liturgical life and to guide them into more fruitful Mass participation. So let's talk about this. Are many of the homilies we listen to each week, are they too long? Father Eric Caden, Director of Vocations and Office of Ministries at the Archdiocese of Boston, has given his fair share of homilies. And our EWTN DC Bureau Chief Matthew Bunsen has done his fair share of critiquing them. Thank you both for being with us. Father Eric, I'm sorry to say that we have all sat through one grueling homily or another, not any of yours, of course. How did you receive this guidance from the Holy Father?
So I welcome it, to be honest. I think it's a great opportunity for myself and for all my brother priests to be intentional, to think about what it is we do, because the priesthood isn't immune or exempt from a complacency that can affect any vocation, any profession. You know, Monsi, the experience of a priest, for the most part, even in a place like New England and Boston, where I'm from, where people can be not as polite, is to be giving a homily. Maybe it was a really good one, maybe it wasn't so good. And as we leave Mass, everyone to say, oh, Father, that was so wonderful. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Now, Monsi, I've had a number of times where I've prepared really well and I have what I think is an excellent homily. And as I'm speaking it, I'm recognizing this is terrible. No one is paying attention. No one is connecting. I'm bored. And then as I walk out, everyone says, oh, Father, that was so wonderful. And so I see a real opportunity to challenge myself, to recognize, you know, what is it I'm trying to say, which is Jesus's word to his people? And how can I be docile to my own strengths and weaknesses? How can I work on what I contribute to the message that Jesus is trying to bring every day and every Sunday to his people?
Amen. That's
so
a beautiful
it's a real
reflection.
Opportunity.
A beautiful reflection and a challenge, I think. Matthew, it's great to have you with us again in this show for more discussion. Do the Pope's comments carry weight as an order to bishops or an order to Father Caden? How serious is this?
Well, I think anytime a Pope weighs in on a subject, any subject, especially as it relates to the liturgical life and sacramental life of the Church, people pay attention. I can think a few years ago where Pope Francis weighed in a bit on some of the wording of the Our Father and lead us not into temptation, and a lot of people took that very seriously. So an admonition from the Holy Father, I think, is worth listening to. I think he's trying to impart important advice, as Father's just been really stressing to us here. I think we also have to factor in that in some parts of the world, many parts of the world, it will be received in a slightly different way. And what I mean by that is that in a place like Africa, where very lengthy homilies are considered the norm, there will have to be a balancing act. But I think some of the advice that Pope Francis is giving even there, I think, will be important. The idea of using imagery and having something that helps to nurture and foster a real participation in liturgical life, which, of course, is something the Second Vatican Council called for.
That's true. And Father Eric, what is the purpose of the homily? Of course, the burning question from all Catholics is it actually required? Is it okay that it gets replaced by the annual appeal sometimes?
You know, I was reflecting on this upon reading the Pope's remarks. And, you know, as a parish priest, a diocesan priest, we are fathers to the people in our community as stewards of the message and the formation and the sanctification that the Father in heaven wants to bring to all of his children. And so we recognize that, of course, the homily is very important because we're walking a people through the word that Jesus wants to bring. You know, the late Cardinal George spoke to us when I was in the seminary, and he had a wonderful remark where he said, you know, the text of the parish priest is the lectionary. And, you know, when you meet a really wonderful and wise and holy parish priest, he knows God's word so well. He's gone through it so many times. But more importantly, he takes on as his mission, bringing his people every day and every Sunday into the life of Jesus and into the extraordinary gift and treasure that his church is. And so, you know, when we recognize, I don't have to tell everything I know right now, because these are the people that God has entrusted to me every day, for many, but for most, every Sunday. And so as I intentionally think about, in prayer, letting Jesus lead, what it is he wants to say, it takes a lot of the relief off, but it also then allows me to work on my own natural skills, to realize what things I'm not good at, to listen to people who speak well, storytellers and other public speakers, and to learn from them, because to bring a craft as an instrument of not my message, but of Jesus's message to his people. And so, of course, it's a wonderful part of the Mass, of helping as a father to draw his people more deeply into intimacy and relationship and love of God, of his church, through his word. I mean, it's a wonderful opportunity.
It is. It's fantastic. Matthew, where do homilies then fit in the historic structure of the Mass? Have they evolved over time?
They have. Well, the oldest of the surviving homilies that we have is the Second Epistle of Clement, which goes to the second or early third century. Then we find a body of homilies among some of the great fathers and doctors of the Church. I think, for example, of St. Ambrose of Milan, St. John Chrysostom, who give us homilies that look very familiar to anyone who listens to them today. The focus has changed a little bit over the centuries. So, for example, in the medieval era, homilies tended to be much more focused on morality and also helping people to be strengthened in their understanding of the teachings of the faith. We have today a real stress, especially coming out of the Second Vatican Council, on helping as the Code of Canon Law, which mandates homilies for Sunday Masses and holy days of obligation and encourages them, even on weekday Masses when you have a large enough congregation. Here we have, as the Code itself stresses, revealing the mysteries of faith and the norms of Christian life as they are revealed in the Scriptures themselves, above all in the Gospel. So while, yes, there have been stylistic changes in the way homilies are delivered or where there might be a little emphasis, at the heart of it remains the homily as unpacking the Gospel, of revealing those mysteries of faith, and then serving as a key link between the liturgy of the Word and the liturgy of the Eucharist.
Well, that's incredibly interesting. And Father Caden, we'll look to see how your homilies change in the future. Thank you both so much.
Good to be with you.
Thank you for having me.
We usually do have a police officer or so that is a parishioner that comes to Mass anyway also. But it's always better to be prepared, in my opinion.
Next, safeguarding houses of worship. In what may be a sign of the times, we examine the increasing presence of security guards and guns in church and parishioners who may be carrying concealed weapons just in case. This against the backdrop of mourning mass shooting victims as Pope Francis comments on recent gun violence in America. The Week in Review is next.
Catholic leadership response to the mass shootings in California tops our news in the Week in Review. Two separate attacks a week ago struck fear within the Asian American community and claimed the lives of nearly 20 people. In the largest mass shooting in Los Angeles County history, a 72-year-old man opened fire at a ballroom dance studio in the town of Monterey Bay. 11 people were killed, 9 others injured, during a Lunar New Year celebration in the Asian American community. All of the victims were in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. After fleeing the dance studio, the gunman tried to enter a second club minutes later, but an employee confronted him and disarmed him during a brief struggle. The suspect died of a self-inflicted gunshot as police closed in on his van the next day. As the community mourns, investigators have not yet determined a motive. The gunman was a regular at the clubs, but was considered mostly a loner. And 2 days later, in the small town of Half Moon Bay near San Francisco, a 66-year-old Chinese national opened fire in back-to-back shootings at two mushroom farms, killing 7 current and former co-workers, most of them Asian and Hispanic migrant workers. His arrest played out before television cameras after he drove to a sheriff's department parking lot. He has been charged with 7 counts of murder. Sheriff's officials did not cite a motive, but said the suspect had a history of workplace rage.
Sorry that we have joined the list of counties around this country that have had to deal with this. Well, I always hoped that that would not be something that would occur in my career, but now that it's here, we'll step up and we'll see that justice gets done.
Including these two California incidents, there have been 40 mass shootings in the United States already this year, more than at this point in any year on record. Archbishop Salvatore Cordileone of San Francisco commented on the massacres.
The recent shootings in Monterey Park and now in Half Moon Bay remind us of how fragile human life is, but also how precious human life is. We must never take human life for granted. We must never take out our aggressions and our frustrations on others, and especially in any form of violence.
The Archbishop of Los Angeles, Jose Gomez, also responded to the shootings with a request for prayer for all those involved. And Pope Francis sent Gomez a condolence telegram, expressing his sadness about the news and assuring his spiritual closeness to all those affected by the tragedies. As violence escalates across society, so does concern about potential targeting of places of worship. We've seen such tragedies in mass shootings at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018 that claimed 11 lives, and in Sutherland Springs, Texas, when a gunman killed 26 worshipers during a Baptist church service in 2017. And just last year, a hostage situation at a synagogue in North Texas. That and the uptick in vandalism of churches has led to conversations about guns in church for self-defense. According to ConcealedCarry.com, the states in blue allowed concealed carry in churches, as church properties can act like private properties and defend themselves. Two states, in red, New York and Mississippi, do not allow concealed carry in churches. In those states colored yellow, it is permissible as long as the pastor allows it. Reporter Alan Holdren explores the presence of guns in church for self-defense and security with a visit to a Catholic archdiocese in America's heartland.
Oklahoma City's inner city is home to the Cathedral of Our Lady of Perpetual Help. A couple of months ago, the parish decided it needed a security detail.
After all the violence and shooting and things like that, we just decided that it was probably time to do that. Any entrance and exiting has to come through these main doors where there is police presence. And so the police, if someone looks kind of iffy, then he just kind of watches over them. And people have said it makes them feel much safer than they did previously.
Father Rick Stansberry himself feels greater peace, he says, now that a former Oklahoma City police officer is ensuring security.
It's not cheap, but, you know, it's well worth it as far as I'm concerned, just to keep people safe, and it's just a way of reassuring.
The cathedral parishioners feel it's justified.
It's kind of a mixed feelings that I have. I do appreciate that security, but I'm also saddened by the fact that we have to have that.
you do find your mind wondering, what would I do if there was an active shooter? What would I do if there was a threat? Where would I tell my family to go? What would I do personally? How would I respond? I think that that speaks to where we're at as a society, that we even have to worry about that in places of worship.
It's retired Oklahoma City police officer Frank Torres that's providing the protection.
I patrol the grounds. When I get here about a half an hour early, and I walk the campus because they have a school here also, but they're not in school during mass, of course, but check the playground, make sure nobody's on the property that shouldn't be on the property.
30-year police force veteran Master Sergeant Torres says it's unlikely he's the only one carrying a firearm at mass.
There's no law against it unless the private property of the church says they don't want guns on the property, then they can't bring them on. But if they don't state that, they're allowed to bring them on the property.
Archbishop Paul Coakley leads Catholics in Oklahoma City. He's also the head of the U.S. Bishops Committee on Domestic Justice and Human Development. In both roles, he has repeatedly appealed to people of goodwill to join him in prayer and action to curb gun violence in America.
There are far too many illegal guns on the streets and far too many people dying of gun violence, not just in our schools, but in our homes and families and throughout our society. So it's a massive problem that's not going to be addressed by any one measure, but I think we need to raise awareness that this is something that all of us are diminished by.
Early on in his tenure as Archbishop, he instituted a policy prohibiting parishioners from bringing weapons to Mass, encouraging instead the hiring of off-duty or retired police, like Master Sergeant Torres, to keep watch.
I don't think it makes us any safer to have parishioners armed. I think we want to take security seriously. There's a lot of ways that we can provide security without arming parishioners in church.
The threat of gun violence and protection from it isn't an issue isolated only to Oklahoma. Parishes across the nation hire security. And given that very few states regulate the presence of guns in houses of worship, some individuals are taking on the responsibility for security personally.
I carry a M&P bodyguard. It's a little 380, and it's about the size of my hand.
If he can help it, David Knappert Jr. of Beloit, Kansas, doesn't go anywhere without his sidearm, not even to Mass.
I had already been carrying anytime we left town, but I thought it would also be prudent to just continue carrying in other places like Mass, because you never know like when something could happen. It's always better to be prepared.
And did you ask for permission from the parish priest?
I did not, and the reason for that is because I feel like generally it's better if you're concealed carrying to just keep it anonymous. Legally, that's okay to do in the state of Kansas. And I have a concealed license, although I'm not legally required to do so. But there's only a handful of states that would legally require you to ask permission from the property owner in order to do that.
If there were a policy in place in the parish concerning weapons, would you follow it?
I would, but I would also highly recommend that the parish or diocese at least allow for a group of people who are maybe pre-approved and trained to allow them to carry, just so that there's at least something there. Because when you enact measures like that, where you're saying that certain people or that people in general shouldn't be allowed to carry, you're not going to be stopping those who just don't obey the law. And most mass public shootings happen in gun-free zones, according to the FBI's own data.
There are certainly differing opinions about gun policy in the U.S., but there is a consensus on one thing. Churchgoers need to be able to worship in peace. In Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Alan Holdren, EWTN News in Depth.
Alan joins us now to share more thoughts and impressions after reporting on this story. The subject of church security and guns is a really sensitive topic. Alan, I understand even among your own family and friends, there was a pretty strong debate, strong opinions, after you gave them a preview of this story and the conversations you've been having over the last couple of months.
Sorry, Monty. And these are conversations that have been taking place in my family for years. I remember the most animated discussions and perhaps the ones that were a little bit offensive at times to some family members were those about guns being carried in public or guns being used to protect people. Why do we have to do that? is the question that it comes down to at the end of the day. And do we have to do that? And if you look at the numbers, there's reasonable debate to be had there. And that's the debate that plays out in my family and so many families around the country. And everybody sounds reasonable. You know, I would much rather not carry guns. But do we need to do that? That's the question.
It's a new debate, especially coming out of COVID, where you had a lot of civil unrest and desires to get rid of police presence. So it did get political, and also it got personal. How do you suggest then, after having these difficult conversations, we have these conversations as our families, in our families, in our parishes?
Monty, this is a conversation that we've been having as a nation, in particular in the last 5 years, is that debate has to be civil in the family, in public, and we need to talk about it. The worst thing that we could do is not talk about it. If you think about, I'm a teacher, right? I'm in the school building right now. We have security systems we've put in place in the last 5 years to block against a threat like this. We have now drills that we do for partial and full lockdowns in the school building with all of the students. We are training, we're preparing for that possibility. If we didn't, it would be irresponsible. The whole reason this debate came about and this news package came about, this discussion, in my mind, was a persuasive paper that one of my seniors wrote last year about how teachers would be irresponsible if they didn't carry guns to protect their students. That got me thinking. We haven't taken action on that in particular, but these are all questions that need to be addressed.
Absolutely. Questions that are on the hearts of students and adults in our country. Thank you so much, Alan.
Thank you, Monty.
Still ahead, she was underestimated as a woman and a foreign newcomer, but the professionalism of a Catholic woman wins out, turning doubters into supporters. The story of the veterinarian now entrusted to care for one of the most prized animals in Arab society.
The sport of falconry is part of the rich, ancient culture of many Arab nations. The birds of prey are among the most prized and treasured possessions. A Catholic woman from Europe entered the guarded and male-dominated Muslim world of falconry 30 years ago. As our Colin Flynn reports, her faith, determination, and hard work now make her an indispensable leader in the world of falconry.
Just outside the city of Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, surrounded by the desert sand, is a hospital like no other. And inside, Dr. Margaret Muller is in the operating theater, where her patient is seriously ill, but going to make it.
If I look in the eyes of the falcon, it's like, you know, you have these little black eyes, and I can really sense what this falcon wants to tell me.
Opened in 1999, this is the largest and most renowned falcon hospital in the world, and has pioneered research and best practices into medical treatment of falcons and other types of birds.
The Abu Dhabi Falcon Hospital is a very special and very unique place. It is the largest hospital for falcons in the world. We treat more than 11,000 falcons per year, and it's a huge number, not only from the United Arab Emirates, but as well from the other Gulf countries.
And here in the United Arab Emirates, falconry is not just a sport, it runs much deeper and is part of the identity of the Emirati people.
Like in the old days when the falconers were still Bedouins, they used falcons to hunt the meat to let the family survive. So the falcon was the integral part, actually, to help for the survival of the families.
Originally from Bavaria in Germany, Dr. Muller, in 1994, at the age of 32, moved here to the United Arab Emirates with a dream.
When we are born, God has it's a kind of book for us. It's a guided path that is there for us, and it is up to us to go along. I was asked to come to the United Arab Emirates. I didn't apply in this hospital. I didn't even know that hospital here. So one day they called me in Germany and said, you know, we have a job for you as a veterinarian. You want to come to the Falcon Hospital to take care of the falcons? And I was first a bit, okay. I said, okay, I go for 1 year. It's an adventure.
What Dr. Muller thought was going to be an adventure of a lifetime turned out to be quite a struggle in the beginning.
Falcon is a man's world, and I wasn't really aware of that when I came here. I was just thinking, I want to heal the Falcons.
After getting a job in the Falcon Hospital, it quickly became apparent that she had a talent and skill with the birds and was made a manager.
I really had to push through to prove myself that even as a woman, you are able to do that and you can do this successfully.
Did you find that they would not take you seriously because you were a woman?
They simply thought I can't do it. It's not even that they didn't take me seriously. They simply thought I'm not able to do it. And in the beginning, they refused to let me touch the Falcons. It was so frustrating. It was just depressing in the beginning.
It was when emergency cases turned up at the hospital and Dr. Muller was the only one there that could help, things started to change.
And then they started to realize, oh my God, somehow the Falcons are starting to survive, because before, all the Falcons in the intensive care and as emergencies, they didn't make it. So suddenly they started to survive. So they said, okay, maybe she knows a little bit. So over the years, they realized, yeah, she knows more and she's fine.
What gave you the courage and the conviction to keep on going when you come up against such obstacles?
First of all, I love the Falcons. I've always loved them. I said, I'm not going to give up, because when I have the feeling it's right what I'm doing, then I will go ahead, no matter which obstacles are in my way. And I always believe that each one of us has a certain ability. It's a gift of God, which I believe that each one of us has. And I believe that we have been brought in this world to fulfill these gifts.
And her determination worked, eventually being appointed as the executive director of the entire hospital, and was even presented with the highest national civic award by the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates, which translates as half man.
How do you deal with that, and what do you think when they tell you that? Do you take it as a compliment, or do you roll your eyes, or what do you think?
Actually, it's a compliment and it's an honor, because for them it means that they accept me. They are not looking at me anymore as a woman, they accept me as a professional, and it's a huge compliment, really, and really a great honor.
And being a Catholic, Dr. Muller has always turned to her faith as a source of strength.
3 years ago, in 2019, I saw Pope Francis in Abu Dhabi, and it was an incredible event. It was just so moving, something you cannot even imagine.
It must be so rewarding for you when you see a sick falcon come in here, maybe at death's door, and then you can bring it back to full health again and see it leave.
That's such a beautiful feeling in your heart that you cannot even explain it. It's just such a peace in your heart, such a beautiful feeling, such a serenity that you can compare it with nothing. Never give up. Trust yourself. It's amazing what you can do if you just believe in yourself. You can achieve more than you can ever imagine.
In the United Arab Emirates, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
It's not every day that we contemplate the veterinary care for birds of prey. Our thanks to Colm for yet another beautiful story about a unique Catholic. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Join us again this time next week for more news and reports about this Catholic life. See you then.